Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have a fabulous show for you today on a really, really important topic that I'm really looking forward to delving into. I have with me two guests. First, Dr. Kyle Sanchez, who is a senior anesthesia resident and doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's originally from Florida, where he did med school, but he's now in Boston at MGH for his residency. He's about to become, like in 3 days, a CA3, and that is very exciting. His interests include transgender health, perioperative medicine, and critical care. My second guest is Dr. Dan Ellis, who is the medical director of the Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, or ERAS, program at Mass General Hospital. He's the director of urology, gynecology, and kidney transplant anesthesia at MGH, and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. He's a native Texan. He and his husband have spent the last 14 years living in Boston. Welcome, both of you, to ACRAC.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kyle, let's start. We're going to talk about the perioperative care of transgender and gender diverse patients. And so let's start with kind of a general introduction. Tell us a little bit about the two of you published a fabulous article on this in ANA. And so, you know, tell us a little bit about what got you interested in the topic and what is the general background you think people need to know to launch us into the actual perioperative care discussion.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for the awesome introduction. Before we get into the actual anesthetic considerations, I think it's important for all anesthesiologists, anesthetists to have a general understanding of the basics of gender terminology, of transgender health. So that's what we are going to kind of start with. I'll start with some really simple definitions. So it's important for us to think about sexual orientation and gender as two different terms. Sexual orientation being defined as an inherent, enduring attraction to other people, an attraction that can be emotional, romantic, sexual, or a combination. Importantly, a statement of sexual orientation has nothing to do with what gender a person identifies as. In terms of gender, the way that I think of it is the male or female division of a species as best differentiated by social and cultural roles and behavior. To kind of break that apart, you can think of gender as having four different dimensions. One being assigned sex at birth, which is the sex assigned based on the visual appearance of the external genitalia. We mentioned gender role, which encompasses how we're expected to act, speak, dress, groom, and conduct ourselves based on our assigned sex. Gender expression, which is the manifestation of the characteristics of one's personality, appearance, and behavior, as such, culturally defined as masculine or feminine. And then finally, gender identity, which is the gender that one actually identifies with and reflects the internal sense of self as male, female, open to both, or neither. So I mention all of this because the two that we most commonly think about are assigned sex at birth and gender identity. Today, we're really focused on gender identity as the most important of these dimensions. So in terms of the different types of gender identities, the most common is cisgender, which is when your assigned sex at birth matches your gender identity. There's transgender, which is when your assigned sex at birth is different than your gender identity. And then there's non-binary, which simply means that you do not identify as male or female. For the purposes of today's talk, when I say the word transgender, when Dan says the word transgender, we're being inclusive of all non-cisgender identities. So even though this is technically not the correct umbrella term, when I say the word transgender, I'll refer to both transgender and non-binary patients. And another important term is when we say transgender male. That means an individual who has a female assigned sex at birth but a male gender identity, and then vice versa for a transgender female. So in terms of interacting with the patients, we've all heard about pronoun use. It's really important to be sensitive to that, to one's chosen name and pronouns. Addressing patients by the wrong name or misgendering them can feel disrespectful and harmful to these patients. It can create an unsafe environment to the person being misgendered, because essentially misgendering them kind of does result in marginalization and communicates to them that their identity is not really seen or respected. These individuals actually call the process of misgendering to be dead naming, because that name is like literally dead to them. So, of course, like kind of as I alluded to, misgendering can result in, you know, threatening the physician-patient alliance. And these interactions over time can lead patients to mistrust the health system. There's a ton of studies to back up what I'm saying that show that using the chosen name, especially for youth, reduces mental harm, mental health risks, including depression and suicidal behavior.
And Kyle, let me just ask, it seems like a clear best practice here, and I know a lot of hospitals are doing this, is to have this in the chart, right? So that physicians can find it there and then use the correct pronouns. What if it's not there? What's the way to address that? And what's a, you know, respectful way a clinician can ask for that information if it's not available in the chart?
Yeah, I think that's a great point to bring up. And nowadays, a lot of the most common EMRs do have that as a box, but sometimes those boxes are wrong. Like what if the gender identity was before they transitioned? So it is actually often wrong in there too. But yeah, it's good to have an EMR that has both the gender identity and the pronouns. If you're not sure, and even if you see any transgender patient in the chart, I would just ask them because you don't know, again, if it's correct. I would say something along the lines of, hi, my name is Dr. Kyle Sanchez. My pronouns are he, him. What would you like me to refer to you as? What are your pronouns? I would just say something like that by first kind of introducing yourself and then, you know, trying to elicit that information from them. And I would say that most, if not all transgender patients would not take the way that I phrased that offensively just now. I think that it's way better to do that than to assume he, she, they, them or something. And then one more thing on that note that I meant to mention also is that if you're ever unsure and you're to use a pronoun, it's sometimes safe to use the word they. If you use the word they, it doesn't necessarily misgender them. It's kind of a neutral pronoun. So that can be something you do like in their absence before you've gotten to ask them what their pronoun is.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's what there actually was one study done on this that showed that, in terms of like inputting stuff in the chart, it is important for us to know their sex assigned at birth. Cause that has implications in terms of insurance and legal things and stuff like that. So there was a study done that showed that first asking for their gender identity and then asking for their sex assigned at birth has been shown to be the most effective and result in the least amount of patient dissatisfaction and whatnot. So again, being like, what's your gender identity? And then what was your assigned sex at birth rather than asking for the assigned sex at birth first. So other than, you know, using the correct terminology and all of that, it's also important for us as anesthesiologists to be aware of the overall broad process of gender affirmation. The details of this are way past the scope of this talk, but just kind of from a broad perspective, we think of gender affirmation as a really complex, multifaceted, and highly individualized process. So it includes social transitioning, such as change of name, pronoun, gender expression, legal and financial changes, psychological support, and also medical and surgical interventions. When I say medical interventions, that kind of is broken into two broad categories. We have pubertal suppression and gender-affirming hormone therapy. I think it is important for us to understand the basics of what those two terms actually mean. So when we talk about pubertal suppression, that basically utilizes GnRH agonism to halt secondary sexual characteristics from developing while the adolescent is still trying to figure out what their gender identity is. So it essentially buys them time to really explore the other gender and to decide whether they want to make a permanent change. It's completely reversible, and the adolescents will continue through puberty if they decide to maintain a cisgender identity and discontinue the pubertal suppression. And they can suppress puberty as long as they want. Some people even suppress it into their 20s. So again, it's a reversible process, and it does not utilize hormones. When we talk about gender-affirming hormone therapy, that's when you utilize testosterone or estrogen to induce basically partially irreversible secondary sexual changes. This is most often done after an adolescent has already undergone a period of pubertal suppression. We typically think of this as more of a permanent change. However, if they were to stop their estrogen or testosterone, some changes will revert back. Now, when we break down into gender-affirming surgery, We can break that down into either transmasculine or transfeminine surgery. Although some non-binary patients may pursue a combination of these surgeries. So technically those terms aren't always, you know, the most politically correct, for lack of a better term, but it's easier to think of them as that way. When we use say the word top surgery, that refers to any chest reconstruction surgery, whether it's transfeminine or transmasculine. When we talk about bottom surgery, that refers to any genital urinary reconstruction surgery. Again, it can be transmasculine or transfeminine. The most common transmasculine surgeries would be a bilateral mastectomy, which would be their top surgery, a phalloplasty or metoidioplasty, which are the two most common bottom surgeries. And then there's various facial masculinization surgeries. When we talk about transfeminine surgeries, that would most often include a breast augmentation mammoplasty, a vaginoplasty, a feminization laryngoplasty, which is used to make the pitch sound more feminine, or a chondrolaryngoplasty or tracheal shave, which is essentially getting rid of the Adam's apple. All right, so now that we've covered kind of a big, broad view of all of this stuff, you might be wondering, like, how is this relevant? How could we make a difference in the care of these patients as anesthesiologists? So we're going to kind of organize the next three sections of the talk as being, we're going to think of things in the preoperative and then intraoperative and then postoperative period. So I'm going to hand it over to Dan to talk about some things that we like to think about for these patients preoperatively.
Fabulous. Thanks. Thank you, Kyle. Dan, tell us, what do we want to keep in mind in the preoperative setting for these patients who we're taking care of?
Thanks, Jed. And actually, before I jump into that, I really liked your question earlier about how do you, as an anesthesiologist, how do you, as an anesthesia professional and an anesthetist, how do you really approach these patients? And what is the best way to be respectful and also put the patient at ease and make them feel comfortable? What I do is what's very similar to what Kyle does, which is I introduce myself as, you know, my name is Dan Ellis, and I use mostly masculine pronouns. And what would you like for me to call you? And I think just asking the question, what would you like for me to call you, is probably the easiest way to get that information and make it a safe space. So that's one approach. Kyle's approach also is very, very similar. And, you know, I think just having a curiosity about the patient and also coming from a respectful place makes a big difference. And so that would be my recommendation there.
Right.
And that really does dovetail nicely into the preoperative consideration. So, you know, we talked about being respectful of folks and also, you know, what do you do with the EMR? What do you do with the forms that are out there? Well, first off, in a perfect world, you'd have forms that are inclusive, that not only have male, female, non-binary language available, because that's going to be what your patients need. So forms should have sex assigned at birth, gender identity, name, and pronouns. But on the off chance that they don't, pay attention to what's written on the photo ID. Kyle mentioned earlier about insurance, about medical legal issues. Those are very real. If there's incongruencies there, bills may not get paid. You may not be able to obtain medical information, medical records, if you go to a different institution, if you go to a different hospital. And so being mindful of that is really important. Additionally, we need to talk about some of the medications that are used in the preoperative setup for the patients. Estrogen is probably the most commonly discussed one medication here. And so we're talking primarily about trans femme patients, so folks who are transgendered feminine, who are on either estrogen replacement or estrogen for hormonal therapy. So estrogen is known to cause venous thromboembolism. That's a well-established fact. But we need to get really specific in how we talk about that. So I'm going to spend some time actually really drilling into that. Estrogen has been known to cause venous thromboembolism because it has a first pass metabolism through the liver, and through the liver, it actually causes these procoagulant effects. Now, a lot of surgeons will say that you need to hold estrogen for 2 to 4 weeks before surgery because of this, but the transgender population is a little bit different. A lot, if not almost all of the trans femme patients will be using transdermal estrogen rather than the oral estrogens that are implicated in the venous thromboembolism. And as a result, because you're avoiding most of that first pass metabolism by going transdermal, you don't get as many VTEs. But if you stop the medication, you're essentially inducing menopause in folks. So what you're getting is mood instability, hot flashes, gender dysphoria, and a lot of really awful feelings. Additionally, the fear of having to stop the medication can be enough for a patient to push off a surgery. So it's not only the physical and the actual biological implications of this, but there's some social and psychological implications as well. Now, a lot of folks will point to some studies from 2015 to 2017, which show that venous thromboembolism can be up to 6% in transgender patients. But it's important to really kind of drill into this. When you look into those studies, you'll find out that the type of estrogen that's used is ethinyl estradiol. Now, that's kind of a mouthful, but the short version is that stuff really causes a lot of blood clots. It's hypercoagulable, and it's not really used anymore, especially not in the transgender population. You're going to still see folks taking ethinyl estradiol for oral contraceptive therapy, but it's in much lower doses than what were used in the 2015s, 2016, 2017, essentially when those studies were done. What I can say is that there is a formulation of estradiol that's used, the sublingual formula, which is a little bit different than the transdermal formula, but the 17-beta estradiol, it's used more commonly because you can actually follow blood levels of it. So it allows for much careful titration of the medication and also lower incidence of thromboembolism. So it's a really good medication. All right, how do we distill this down? What should the folks know who are taking care of patients? Well, 2021 is probably some of the best data out there. A little over 900 patients had about 1,400 gender-affirming surgeries. They did not see a difference in thrombosis when folks were on estrogen therapy and those who were not on estrogen therapy. So I want to say that one more time. In other words, they looked at almost 1,000 folks. They did not see any difference in blood clotting in folks who continue the estrogen therapy. And that really picks up on what I started out the conversation with. Now, when it comes to taking testosterone, it's not really a big deal. We don't really see as many of the effects on the cardiovascular system. There is some evidence on cardiovascular system, but nothing really statistically significant that has been identified now. All right, so if you're in your pre-op clinic, what do you do about your labs when you have folks who are transgender? Well, the cheat code here, the real takeaway is after a couple months of hormonal therapy, just follow the lab values that compare to the gender identity rather than the assigned sex at birth. In other words, if someone is presenting as trans feminine or trans masculine, use trans feminine, use female values. Trans masculine, use masculine values or male values, because that's going to be your best comparative group. All right, now what about pregnancy testing? This is going to be controversial. This is sensitive. This requires a high degree of emotional intelligence. You got to be thoughtful about this. If a person has already had a hysterectomy and a bilateral salpingo oophorectomy, you don't really need to worry about pregnancy because there's not going to be an opportunity for an oocyte or a fetus to implant. But in the absence of that, you got to really think about, does the test make sense? Does the test make a difference to the patient and their care pathway? Unintended pregnancies happen, even if you're on testosterone, if you still have a uterus, if you still have ovaries and fallopian tubes. The ASA does not have recommendations here for assigned sex at birth patients who have childbearing age, but they do say consider pregnancy testing if it would alter the patient's management. Also important to recognize that asking someone to urinate into a cup can be really triggering. So you may want to consider serum testing of this. So I'm not really giving an answer about whether or not you should or should not do it. I'm just encouraging folks to be thoughtful, be sensitive. There are no set guidelines. Pregnancy can occur. And so as a result, you have to think about it. Now, in terms of intraop, I'm going to hand it back to Kyle to talk us through that portion.
Thanks, Dan. And a lot of really, I learned a ton from what you just said. So really important to know that data about venous thromboembolisms, and we should be updating our approach there. And not, certainly, it sounds like we should not be asking people to stop their estrogen, assuming they're using, as you said, these newer formulations in the transdermal or sublingual approach. Really important to know. And then the pregnancy testing is interesting. I feel like in general, this is something that's changed a lot. And, you know, there certainly when I was training, I'm sure for you too, Dan, right? It was like you could not go forward if you did not have a pregnancy test, if you were a person who could be pregnant. And now even for anybody, I think we're often saying like, look, if you don't want it, if you can't pee or you're saying, listen, I'm fine going forward. I don't need the test. Like we can document that and be okay. But then there's the added, like, how do we approach this with the patient who is trans masculine? And do we ask or not? And do you, would you recommend, you know, asking, just saying to the patient, you know, we've had the conversation that you said at the beginning, right? We've asked about your assigned gender at birth and about your preferences now. And so if they've said to you, yeah, my assigned gender at birth was female, now I identify as male, but I still have my uterus and my fallopian tubes and my ovaries, would you recommend asking them? You know, we would typically do a pregnancy test, but it's your call, or how would you approach that?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care Plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
All right, and we're back.
Yeah, sometimes the best thing to do is just acknowledge the awkwardness of the situation. Something as simple as saying, look, I have a really sensitive question to ask. I recognize that you identify as male, but, you know, at this point, you still have your uterus, you still have, you know, you have not had a hysterectomy. And so what we will often do is offer a pregnancy test unless the patient says, absolutely no way I could possibly be pregnant, and they're comfortable proceeding without that. And I know that this is a sensitive topic and I want to acknowledge that, but this is something that we need to talk about. You know, ignoring the topic doesn't work, but also not being sensitive to the patient's needs and vulnerabilities doesn't work either. So sometimes for me, at least, just saying the awkward part out loud and acknowledging that it's awkward is the best path forward.
I love that. Yeah. And just, that's a great lesson in general, right? When you're feeling awkward, so probably the patient is too, and just being able to say, like, hey, like, let's work together here because we, you know, we got to get through this, but it's a tough thing. And I think just humanizing it, right? I think that makes a big difference to people.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Fabulous. All right. Well, Kyle, let's talk about intra-op now. So what do we want to keep in mind in the intraoperative period?
Yeah. Thank you. I want to add one more thing to the pregnancy testing thing that you can offer patients is, and Dan touched on it briefly, that for some patients, the act of peeing in the cup for them, like, actually causes dysphoria themselves. So as long as, you know, you have enough time in the pre-op period, you can offer them a blood test or a serum beta HCG instead and send it kind of as a stat lab. And then sometimes that actually does kind of, it meets them in the middle, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Great.
But anyway, so in terms of intraoperative considerations, if they're going to continue estrogen, and especially if they're patients that are already higher risk of DVT, then, you know, at a certain discretion, you know, considering using intraoperative VTE prophylaxis, so like sulpeheparin, basically. Now, we talked about different drugs pre-op. So in terms of intra-op, there hasn't been any data to support that there's any drug-drug interactions between estrogen, the various androgen blockers, so like leuprolide, and testosterone directly with anesthetic medications, which is great. However, we should consider the potential interaction between sugammadex and estrogen. So this is not something that's been studied, but if you think about it, it makes sense. So as most of us know, sugammadex reverses paralysis by basically encapsulating the steroidoneuromuscular blocking agents. And as a lot of us also know, it's been shown to potentially reduce the potency of other steroidomolecules such as estrogen. Those studies were done kind of in the pre-sugammadex being clinically used phase. But for this reason, like on the label, it says if you've had a dose of sugammadex, you should use alternative contraceptive for up to 7 days. There hasn't been a lot of studies like past this to show like the significance of this effect clinically. But if that recommendation does exist and that interaction does exist, then I think someone can infer that sugammadex may also reduce the potency of estrogen hormone therapy. So again, this hasn't been studied, so we can't officially make recommendations. But the way that I approach this is if this is a patient for whom reversing potentially with neostigmine glycopyrrolate won't, you know, but it is doable and won't, you know, affects their case in any negative way, then maybe consider doing that.
And I'll just say, and I'm sure Dan will agree, that it used to be that everybody got Nosy-Vec, like, there was Nosy-Vec, and that was all we had, and everybody got it and did fine. So, you know, everyone should, I think every trainee should know how to use it and know that it's a perfectly acceptable alternative to Nosy-Vec.
Yeah, yeah, definitely agree with that as someone in residency who's used it only a handful of times. So I think this is a great opportunity to, like, use that comfortably. But so in terms of medication dosing, we do dose a good number of our medications based on the ideal body weight, which is a gender-based calculation. So there's been some pharmacy studies on, like, quote-unquote, or when someone's quote-unquote physiology kind of more matches the gender identity when they've been on hormones. And what they kind of decided is that the six-month mark is around when their physiology more matches the gender identity for which they're taking hormones for. So long story short, if they've been on estrogen, testosterone for over 6 months and you're trying to calculate their ideal body weight, then it's best to use the calculation based on their gender identity. And that's kind of also what Dan mentioned about lab values. It's the same six-month mark. So it's also important for us to look at their surgical history, because a lot of the surgeries that they have, the gender-affirming surgeries, do you have important things, important considerations. So, for example, patients who have undergone bottom surgeries, so again, vaginoplasty, phalloplasty, metoidioplasty with urethral lengthening, they often have distorted urethral anatomy, particularly for trans masculine bottom surgery. So, like, for phalloplasties, they have a high rate of urethral stenosis, like up to 60%. And the stricture is usually, like, internal at the anastomosis between the phallic urethra and the vaginal tissue. So you might not even, like, recognize that they have it until they've actually, like, put, like encountered urethral perforation. So because the Foley is often done after induction, like, there actually has been case reports of patients that have had urethral perforations and it's not recognized, so they wake up from anesthesia. So bottom line, I know that we don't, you know, typically place Foleys. If it's not something that the surgical team's really thought too much about and you see that there's difficulty placing a Foley, it's definitely recommended to use smaller caliber catheters over guide wires. But in general, if there's any difficulties at all and there's a urologist around, it'd be probably good to consider asking them. And again, this is usually more of a problem with the transmasculine gender-affirming surgeries. Another thing that's even more relevant to us as anesthesia providers is when transfeminine patients, they often undergo a lot of facial feminization and vocal feminization surgeries. So I'll kind of go through each of them. So when they have the lower facial feminization surgeries, this is typically done they basically alter the articulation of the mandible and do some things with that. So that can actually cause a reduced mandibular height, width, and mobility, and that can make mask ventilation and LMA placement challenging. So they could actually be a difficult mask if they've had these surgeries. And furthermore, if they've had a feminization laryngoplasty, that actually directly distorts the laryngeal anatomy to alter the pitch of their voice. And it has been shown to lead to subglottic stenosis. And of course, a subglottic stenosis that can lead to difficulty with both the intubation and then with the actual passage of the tube. So for patients that have had feminization laryngoplasties, it is recommended to use a smaller diameter intertracheal tube and maybe even consider a fiber optic, depending on what your airway exam is like. Furthermore, chondrolaryngoplasties or tracheal shaves can lead to scar formation over the cricoid membrane. So that can make emergent surgical airway difficult. So basically what I've just said is that they can be both a difficult mask, a difficult intubation, and a difficult surgical airway if they've had all these surgeries. So that's due to all these difficult airway scenarios. It's been recommended by several societies that all these feminization airway facial surgeries should actually be done as their last gender affirming surgery, so that it just, like, reduces the risk of them getting exposed to more difficult airway scenarios, basically. So again, it's important to think about those things.
Kyle, is there any thought on, you know, if they need surgery after having had all three of these, all three of these, you know, do we want to think about awake intubations? Like, how risky is it? Do we think a video, or do we even know the answer? I mean, is a video going straight to video laryngoscopy, is that probably going to do it? Or do we need to actually, you know, be doing awake intubations on these patients?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question that unfortunately we don't have enough data to answer. I think it definitely will depend on the airway exam you have with them, I guess. I think if it is really concerning, then awake fibrotic intubation would be the most safe, or at least if not having like the surgical airway team like in the room or nearby, depending on like what center you're at and what resources you have available. Maybe taking a quick look with the fiber optic scope and some lidocaine while they're awake, and if it doesn't look too difficult, then putting them to sleep. But I think at the minimum, using a smaller tube, having all the backup equipment in the room, talking about potential awake and seeing like what they think about that would probably be the best approach.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. But so another thing that does come up sometimes is breast binders. So transgender male patients who haven't yet had top surgery will often utilize breast binding to reduce the feminine appearance of their chest. It's important for us to realize that these are not cosmetic. This is actually used as a mean of gender expression. And it has been shown like in lots of studies to help reduce chest dysphoria and help reduce depression related to gender dysphoria. So they should be taken seriously, just as serious as the pregnancy testing and all the other things we mentioned. Unfortunately, breast binding has been shown to have both acute and chronic respiratory acute and chronic restrictive respiratory effects due to the obvious compression of the chest. So it is recommended for those to be removed before induction, due to making it difficult in terms of masking them. So I think the takeaway is that this should be a conversation with the patients before they're anesthetized, and it should be done kind of respectfully and sensitively. What shouldn't happen is basically the patient checks into the pre-op area and like a nurse or someone else comes and tells them to take off their breast binder. It doesn't have any conversation about it. Someone should come and tell the patients that we respect their gender expression and their gender identity. This is kind of a safety thing. Another thing about this is trying to replace it as soon as you can. It can be dysphoric for the patients to wake up without their breast binders, especially if they weren't warned that they'll be removed. So I would say, replace as soon as it's safe after extubating them to minimize the post-op chest dysphoria. Did you have a question?
No, I was going to say that, I think these are all really important things to keep in mind intraoperatively. And I was going to ask you from, breast binders, are we talking about a device that is like, how easy is it to take off? I guess, like, is it the kind of thing you could put someone to sleep and then easily take it off? Or does it have to be done by the patient before you get back? Cause it wouldn't be doable on the OR table.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So honestly, what it looks like is it almost looks like a sports bra sort of. It's just basically a piece of like fabric or polyester type fabric that it just wraps around their entire chest and just pushes the chest inward. So it can be easily taken off by the patient, by any provider, basically. And I think it would depend on like, the comfort of the anesthesiologist, but I think in some situations it would be very reasonable to take it off, after you've already pushed the propofol, for example. But I think it would just depend on the clinical situation.
Right. Thank you. All right. So Dan, let's go back to you and talk about post-op. So we've made it through the surgery. What do we want to keep in mind for these patients in the post-operative arena?
Yeah. Also the reference to neostigmine and glycopyrrolate brings back a lot of good memories. I'll leave it at that.
Me too. The pre-Sugammadex days.
Definitely. So post-operative. So the theme of post-operative is just sensitivity. I think if I'm going to just summarize it with one word, it would be just sensitivity. It's important to recognize that there's a lot of prejudice, a lot of discrimination within this patient population. It occurs in healthcare settings, it occurs on the streets, it occurs in everyday life. So being as kind and respectful as one can when interacting with these patients in the PACU is really paramount. Making sure that you don't have a loud discussion about gender identity and about gender affirming surgeries in front of other patients is important. A lot of folks are going to be very self-conscious about coming in for this type of surgery. They're excited, but also a little nervous and feeling very vulnerable. So being able to respect that as much as possible is going to be key to this person's recovery. Also, don't assume that someone's out to their family or their friends. Try to check in with the patient beforehand and say, what would you like us to disclose about your sexual orientation or gender identity to your loved ones? It's complicated. Some people will socially transition before they medically transition. Sometimes they will socially transition after all the surgery is done. And it's really up to the patient to make that decision for themselves rather than a physician, a nurse anesthetist, a nurse, a healthcare provider to make that decision for someone else. Also, figuring out where to room the patient after they leave the PACU is going to be important. You know, assignments should be discussed with the patient prior to its being made. Again, patient may have told their family that they identify as trans feminine, or they may identify as male. And it may make more sense to room that patient in a setting that's according to or congruent with that decision that they have made. The easiest thing to do is to place a person who's had gender-affirming surgery in a solo room. But that in its own right can make the patient feel like they're being excluded, that they're being singled out because they're different, they're othered. And so making sure that you have this discussion in advance is really the best way forward. Also, recognizing that transgender patients have a higher rate of chronic pain than their cisgender counterparts. PCAs, IV PCAs alone, usually don't cut it when it comes to pain after gender-affirming surgeries. Opioid consumption tends to be higher than if regional or neuraxial techniques are employed. And there's a lot of research that's going on into this about neuraxial, about regional epidurals, et cetera. Procedures that can make a difference. Combined lumbar analgesia in the setting of general anesthesia is really better than general anesthesia alone. Pudendal blocks, erector spinae blocks, they also reduce pain scores, especially after bottom surgeries. Paravertebral blocks, they're great for mastectomies at many institutions, and we do them here at our own institution. Recognizing that transgender patients, they have anxiety, they have depression at rates that are higher often than the general population. And those anxieties, those depressions, they really can be exacerbated with the stress of surgery, with the stress of coming into a hospital, with the stress of being vulnerable. And recognizing that is super important. Bringing in a team approach, mental health, social work, spiritual care, making sure that those are addressed in advance is really going to be helpful. And also reaching out to the primary team that's been responsible for this patient's care is going to be really important. You know, there's often a strong alliance between the patient and their primary health provider, which can be very, very helpful in establishing the postoperative course for this patient. And also recognizing that higher rates of smoking, substance abuse, diabetes, chronic health conditions are also going to require more thoughtful care in the recovery room period as well. All right. That's pretty much it in terms of the postoperative care, and then wrapping up the care of the transgender patient.
Great. Such great points that both of you have made. Is there anything that either you want to add that we didn't touch on before we move on?
I don't think so.
I think that covers all the major things.
Great. All right. Well, let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have, Kyle, we'll start with you, something you would recommend the audience check out for fun?
Sure. If anyone is into like a thriller, murder mystery, psychological thriller, I guess, type books, I may recommend this one called The Silent Patient. I just finished reading it last month and it was very good.
Nice. I have heard about that. I haven't read it, but that's definitely on the list. How about you, Dan?
So I'm from Texas, so I love to eat. And I recently learned that you can put Hatch chilies in anything, including croissants. So Hatch chili croissant is my new favorite breakfast taco or breakfast item. A little harder to find up here in the Northeast as opposed to the Southwest, but it is delicious.
Hatch chili. So that's a type of chili pepper?
It is. It is mostly in like New Mexico, West Texas. You can find it out there. But yeah, it's incredible.
Very, very cool. All right. I want to remind everyone about ACRAC in Spanish. So if you are looking for being able to access ACRAC in Spanish, there are more and more episodes coming out. So check that out on Spotify, and you can also find it on Instagram. I'm going to recommend a fantasy series that I just finished, which was really good. It's called the Scholomance Trilogy. The first book is called The Deadly Education by Naomi Novik is the author's name. And it's very, very interesting, very different than a lot of other books in the setting. I don't really want to give it away, but I'll just say that it's worth a read. Really good. Three books, they're pretty fast reads. Very interesting kind of world building, and you fly through it and it's really fun. So check out A Deadly Education, first book in the Scholomance Trilogy. All right, Kyle and Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been great.
Yeah, appreciate you having us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it. This has been awesome. Thank you.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter, we are on Facebook, we are on Reddit, and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.